Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Muslim scholars around the world urge Christian leaders to cooperate more closely in the promotion of justice and peace. Religious sisters get set to launch the first international intercongregational anti-trafficking network. But first, Pope Benedict appeals for the release of two Iraqi priests kidnapped over the weekend in the northern city of Mosul. The plight of two Catholic priests kidnapped in northern Iraq and the 90th anniversary of the apparitions of Our Lady in Fatima, Portugal, were the central themes of Pope Benedict's Angelus address this past Sunday. The Pope was speaking to thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered in St. Peter's Square and to the many thousands more listening to his words at the Marian Shrine in Fatima via video link-up. My colleague Emma McCarthy has all the details of what the Pope had to say.
On the 90th anniversary of the Virgin's apparition in Fatima, Portugal, Pope Benedict XVI launched a strong appeal this Sunday for the release of two Iraqi priests kidnapped in Mosul, Iraq, and for peace throughout the region.
Continuano a giungere quotidianamente dall'Iraq gravi notizie di attentati e violenze.
Speaking to the 40,000 people present in St. Peter's Square and the hundreds of thousands listening in a live link from Fatima, where Mass marking the anniversary presided over by Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone was drawing to close, Pope Benedict XVI said that every day news continues to pour in from Iraq with grave reports of attacks and violence. He said these reports shake the conscience of all who care for peace in the region. Among these reports, added the Pope, I have learned today of the kidnapping of two good priests in Mosul who are being threatened with death. I appeal to their abductors to immediately release these two men of religion. Reiterating that violence cannot resolve conflicts, the Pope concluded with a heartfelt prayer that they may soon be freed and that all those who are suffering may soon have peace.
Soffrono violenza e per la pace.
The anniversary of Fatima, however, was at the heart of Pope Benedict's reflections before the recitation of the Angelus prayer this Sunday.
No santuario di Fatima in Portugal.
Our Lady of Fatima, he said, invited humanity to conversion. The Pope noted that this appeal has also been at the centre of the Virgin's more recent messages.
Alla Madonna chiediamo per tutti I cristiani il dono di una vera conversione.
Before the Angelus prayer, the complete and radical healing power of salvation was the subject of the Pope's reflections on this Sunday's Gospel, which tells of Jesus' healing of 10 lepers, one of whom was a Samaritan and therefore a foreigner, the only one, pointed out the Pope, who returns to thank the Lord.
Into this Gospel, our Lord takes pity on the lepers, cleansing them of their infirmities, and reminding us all of his desire to heal those who suffer.
Pope Benedict observed that we must not consider everything that comes our way as a right, but just like the leper, as a gift. True faith, he said, is expressed in one small word, thanks.
In una piccola parola, grazie.
Pope Benedict continued, once leprosy was considered a disease that needed purification. Today, instead, the leprosy that really deforms man and society is represented by pride and selfishness, which generate indifference, hate, and violence. Pope Benedict XVI concluded, this leprosy of the spirit, which marks the face of humanity, can only be cured by the God who is love. By opening our hearts to this God, by converting to him, we too can be inwardly healed.
May God bless you with the saving power of his peace and love.
My thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address. Muslim-Christian dialogue is back under the spotlight again after 138 senior Muslim scholars from across the globe signed a joint declaration to Pope Benedict and to other Christian leaders proposing increased cooperation in order to promote peace in the world. The letter, made public last week to coincide with the end of Ramadan, stresses the shared beliefs of both Muslims and Christians in one God, saying this must form the basis for greater cooperation and efforts to diffuse current tensions and promote justice and peace. The lengthy letter quotes extensively from both the Bible and the Quran, urging believers to live up to their shared principles of love of God and love of neighbour. Though it's not the first initiative of this kind, the document marks a historic achievement in terms of Islamic unity, being signed by both Sunnis and Shiites under the auspices of a non-governmental Islamic institute in Amman, Jordan. Here in the Vatican, the head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent, welcomed the letter as an interesting and encouraging initiative.
I should say that this is a document in a way new, because it comes from the Shiite and the Sunnite Muslims. It's a non-polemical document with numerous quotations from the Old and the New Testament. And it is a kind of a meditation about love of God and the love of our neighbor. I think the letter shares three convictions that Christians and Muslims have in common. The first is God is unique. The second conviction is God loves us, and so we must love him. And the third conviction, God calls us to love our neighbor. So it's a very challenging letter in that sense, that it shows that goodwill and dialogue are capable to overcome all the prejudices we have.
Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent, the head of the Vatican's Council for Interreligious Dialogue. Other Christian leaders, meanwhile, have also reacted positively to the letter. In England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, welcomed it as a clear reaffirmation of the potential for developing existing dialogue and common action between Christians and Muslims, as well as other faith communities. But what form could this increased cooperation take? And above all, what motivated this invitation from so many Muslim scholars to the world's Christian leaders? Questions I put to a Catholic expert on the Muslim world. Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald is Apostolic Nuncio to Egypt and to the Cairo-based Arab League, as well as former head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue.
Well, I think it is an interesting follow-up to the previous letter that was sent by various Muslim scholars and Muslim leaders who had been meeting in Amman at a meeting organized by the Ahlul Bayt Institute for Islamic Thought. That was the letter of, I think, 36 leading scholars after Regensburg. And this, with a larger number of people signing, seems to be a follow-up of that, and it's an interesting move.
As you say, it's a large number. I think 138 scholars and Muslim leaders have signed up to this. What do you think are the key factors that have led to a common declaration like this from so many Muslim leaders in so many countries around the world?
Well, the interesting feature is that this Ahlul Bayt Institute, which was set up originally by Prince Hassan of Jordan, had been in dialogue with Christians, with the Anglicans first of all, and then with the Orthodox, and then with the Roman Catholic Church. And I myself have taken part in a number of meetings with them. But with the change when King Abdullah came to the throne in Jordan, the direction of this Ahlul Bayt Institute changed slightly and was trying to bring about a greater unity within the Islamic world, and was not really concerned with dialogue with Christians. So that is why I think it explains the presence or the the signatures, at least, of quite a number of leading Muslims from all different parts of the world. I think what we could say is that this is an interesting initiative. I hope it'll be followed up from the Muslim side by perhaps an invitation to meet, you know, that they will take a concrete step, not just leave it like that as a sort of invitation to a common word, but actually take steps to bring Christians and Muslims together.
As you mentioned, this comes a year after the previous letter from Muslim scholars, and it comes, of course, a year after Pope Benedict's address to Muslim leaders following his Regensburg lecture. How significant is this, do you think? How much did last year's events influence, perhaps, this letter?
I would think that it does have an influence, though this is not mentioned anywhere. I don't see it mentioned, but you know, it's always there in people's minds. That is why there is an appeal to Pope Benedict himself. So, yes, Regensburg is always there. But what I would like to say is that the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue has, you know, on the 28th of September, released its message for the end of Ramadan, which is entitled Christians and Muslims Called to Promote a Culture of Peace. So, you know, we're on the same wavelength there, I think, because this call from the Muslims is also saying how important it is for Christians and Muslims to work together for peace. The difficulty is that it's the political leaders who have the power and authority and not the religious leaders. So we can be a moral voice in the world, and we can be a stronger moral voice if we are speaking together, but we have to persuade the political leaders also to take into account what the religious leaders are saying.
Given the large number of Muslim leaders signing this document, though, would you say this in some way must represent a broader voice from the political leaders in the Muslim world or not?
I don't think it's representing the political leaders. Of course, when there are muftis involved, the muftis are appointed usually by the political powers, so they are government appointees. But the article refers to the, you know, the mufti of a leader of millions of Muslims. Well, that isn't actually so. I wouldn't say that all the Muslims in Egypt look up to the mufti as their leader. Yes, the mufti gives pronouncements, but there's a whole war of pronouncements going on in the Islamic world, and there are different voices coming up. So it is an important step, I think, but we shouldn't exaggerate its importance. I would hope that it would be followed up by Christians and Muslims maybe together organizing meetings, different meetings, and the message from the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue emphasized also the responsibility to give this culture of peace to the youth. And I think that is important too. You see, you know, you see a lot of violence in the world, which is actually perpetrated by young people who are being led by others, of course. And this would be a counter move to that, I would think.
Presumably a very significant counter move, because such a unity of voice from Muslim leaders therefore makes it harder for extremist voices to try and represent many people, many Muslims in the different countries.
One would hope that that would be the case, yes, and that this statement will be given large publicity, and I would hope that the statement is not only in English, but is also being published in Arabic and will be spread around the Arabic-speaking world.
My thanks there to Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald, Apostolic Nuncio to Egypt and the Arab League. The U.S. US Embassy to the Holy See and the Italian Union of Major Superiors are teaming up this week on a training seminar for religious sisters working to fight against the scourge of human trafficking. 33 sisters from more than 25 different countries will be taking part in the week-long seminar, which is set to launch the first international religious anti-trafficking network. The aim is to help those already committed to the fight against trafficking for prostitution and to better coordinate the work of congregations already offering support to women who have fallen prey to the traffickers.
We no more speak about prostitution when we deal with these women, because we are very much aware that these women have not chosen to become prostitutes, but they have chosen to come to Europe, to Italy, in order to help their families to better their lives and the lives of the members of the families.
Italian Consolata sister Eugenia Bonetti is well known in Italy and beyond for her pioneering work to help victims of human trafficking. The US State Department has recognized her with a Woman of Courage Award for her dedication to sheltering and rehabilitating women rescued from forced prostitution. After spending many years as a missionary in Africa, Sister Eugenia became very concerned about the numbers of African women who were brought to Italy under the pretext of finding jobs, but ending up as sex slaves on the streets of Italy's big cities.
Because the majority of the women we see on the streets are there because they are forced to be there. This is the difference between being a prostitute because you want to do that, or to be forced to be a prostitute because you have been sold and bought by criminal organization because they want money from these women.
Where do these women mostly come from, and what sort of age are they?
The two biggest groups that we are dealing with, they are Nigerians and Romanians nowadays. There is a difference between the Nigerians and Romanians. Romanians are very young. The majority nowadays we can meet on the streets that are Romanians are below the age of 18.
How young do they get?
They can be even 15, 16, 17 years. They are very young, though they don't say that they are minors. Instead, for the girls from Nigeria, the age is a bit higher. So you can have 19, 20, 21, 22. But there is a difference nowadays with Nigerian women. The ones we are receiving now, they are not educated. So they are coming really from the bush.
And so how are these women being tricked into coming? Is it a case of somebody coming along who's working for the traffickers, who tells them that he can get them a good job in a city or in the West? How does it happen?
Of course, now the recruitment is done normally in places of origin. And this is done either by women or relatives to the women who are the traffickers, or it is done by some men that offer some help when the girls have no option, no opportunities, because they simply say, now, we have a sister, we have a friend, we know somebody that is looking for somebody that can work in their restaurant, in their factories, in their shops, and so they need somebody to help them. Of course, they have no money, they have no documents, but they say, don't worry, we are going to take care of all these kind of things. You should not worry. Once you are in Italy, you will give us back the money we spent for you. So they present themselves as really people who would like to help.
And is that the same in Eastern Europe as well? Is it a similar sort of situation, or are there differences there?
Now, in Eastern Europe situation, it's very different, because in Eastern Europe we have young boys that lure these girls on a pretense of falling in love with them. The majority, they have a young boy that says, now we go to Europe. Now we get married, we work, and when they are in Europe, the girl goes to work on the street and the man eats all the money. For Nigerians, normally we have women exploiting women, which is terrible. The young girls from the East are controlled at the site on the street. Instead, for the Nigerian girls, they are not controlled by anybody, because they are controlled by the voodoo the black magic they have to perform before coming to Italy. And so there is no need for the madams to follow them and to know where they are and what they do. Because this psychological violence, this black magic is performing on these young girls, especially if they are uneducated, it is more than enough to control them and to make them believe that if they run away, if they report the case to the police, the bad spirit is going to hold on them, is going to destroy them, to destroy their families. And we have many, many cases of girls who are mentally sick because of this black magic.
Now, once these girls, by whatever means, they end up in the hands of the pimps in Italy, and they find themselves being tricked into working on the streets, how badly are they treated? Apart from the voodoo, do they sometimes use physical violence to force some of these girls, particularly the girls, say, from Eastern Europe?
For everybody, you know, life on the street is always a great risk, and you have to put into account really mistreatment, not only on the side of pimps or madams, but also on the side of clients, maniacs, so they are always at risk. But the majority that it's done by the pimps and the madams is when the girls are not going back home with money. Maybe sometimes they are not having enough money, so when they go back, they are beaten. They are beaten thoroughly in order to make them work more and to make sure that when they go back at the end of their nighttime or daytime, they can bring 200, 300, 400 euro. Otherwise, they are really very, very much mistreated.
This money, do they have to hand it all over?
All the money, it has to be handed over to the traffickers or to the madame. This is the case in a special way nowadays for Nigerians. Until they have finished to pay their debt, a Nigerian, to be free again, she has to produce more than 70, 80,000 euro.
So how many of them do ever get free? Because that's a huge amount of money.
This is a huge amount of money that for a young girl that has to pay this money, she has to undergo not less than 4,000 sexual encounters. And when she has finished to pay this money, she's also finished in all aspects. Physically, emotionally, psychologically, socially, and that is why this kind of experience is having a very, very bad effect on the life of the dignity of these young girls, because they lose all sense of who they are.
When it comes to the East Europeans who are not, shall we say, the victims of these voodoo, how often do they pluck up the courage or manage to escape from their traffickers?
They have the courage to escape because, especially at the beginning, they were really also mistreated terribly by their pimps. Nowadays, it is a bit more difficult because the pimps have understood that just mistreating them, they were not going very far. So they use a new system. That's why this is a phenomenon that is always on the change. Nowadays, they make a kind of a contract with them, saying, now, if you work for me, I protect you on the streets. I'll give you accommodation. I'll give you everything you need. At the end of the month, I give you a salary. But all the rest of the money will be with me. So they are doing this kind of a trick in order to make the girls not to run away, because they can always say she has agreed. And at the end of the month, I give a salary. Or they do in another way. They pay on a percentage. If you get 100 euro, now you keep 10% and they get 90%. So these kind of things nowadays is becoming very common, and it is becoming more difficult for the girls to have the courage to run away. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done in contacting the girls. That's why we meet them on the streets. We talk to them. We offer them opportunities. We tell them we are willing and ready to protect you, to protect your families, so that you can live a life worth of being lived as women.
But presumably it takes time to build up their trust. It's not often that they would come with you the first time. Presumably
of
you
course,
have to carry on this.
That's why every week we meet these young people on the streets. We meet, we establish a relationship, we know them, we know their stories, they are suffering. We are ready to help them because we have shelters where we can welcome them, we can offer them the opportunity of rebuild again their life, whatever they have been stolen, their dignity, their identity, their youth, their health, because some of them get also very sick. Some of them become pregnant, and so they are forced to go for abortions. We have, for instance, young girls from Eastern Europe that you can count between 3, 4, 5 abortions each. And at the end, they are all broken. They are all destroyed. Since 1998, when the Italian government gave the opportunity to these young girls who had the courage to leave the street and also some of them to denounce their traffickers, we were able to give them a new status.
How many people are we talking about?
We are talking about more than 5,000 young girls who have been able to receive this benefit of a permit to stay and to work in Italy, to be able to start a different life because they have gone through this rehabilitation, reintegration, getting to know the language, getting to know a job, in order to be able to work and to become normal human beings again.
Let's talk a little bit about the clients. Presumably there's no lack of clients for these women who work on the streets. Is that right?
Yes. We would not have such a big number of young women because this is the point. This is a very sad point that unfortunately nobody wants to talk about it. When we speak about this forced prostitution, slavery, trafficking in human beings, we are always focusing our attention on women, especially young women, minors. And it is very seldom that we have the courage to speak about the demand, the consumers. That's why there is a great fight. We really have to fight against this corruption, this organization, and also we have to inform the mentality of our young people to start with so that they can understand that a body of a young girl cannot be bought. Because they simply said, but I pay, so now she does what I want because I give her payment.
So these men, they come from all walks of life. How often are they married?
Now these men, 70% of them have wives, children, or they live with somebody, and that is very sad. When we see cars on the street stopping, picking up these young girls, and at times we can see that there is a sign on the car saying, baby on board, or a babysitter.
Finally, any particular remark made by any of these girls that you've rescued or rehabilitated that really sums up either what they've been through or how they've recovered?
One of the greatest remarks, and the many of the remarks we receive from the girls, it is this: you have saved my life. I was destroyed. I was a dead body walking around because how many times I wanted to get rid of my life because of the humiliation. It is wonderful to see how really working together we can achieve a great deal. And we can give hope for these young people that it is not the end, but it can be the beginning.
Thanks there to my colleague Susie Hodges talking to Sister Eugenia Bonetti, one of the key participants in a seminar this week for religious sisters working to support victims of human trafficking. The seminar, sponsored by the US State Department, takes place behind closed doors, but will conclude with a public session on Friday afternoon. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget you can join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Just a reminder to our regular listeners, if you normally listen to Vatican Radio's English feature programme on 105 FM, as from the last Sunday in October, it will no longer be available on that frequency. You will, however, be able to hear the feature programme on 93.3 FM. Again, that's from the last Sunday in October. You can find the English feature programme on 93.3 FM. So stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.